To the Ask Beauty Show. And if you are feeling down these days, believe me, you are not alone. Look, we were really hoping that perhaps there was going to be a downward tick in what's going on with the virus. But as I read the numbers every day, as I'm sure you do, and we're listening to the reports from bona fide scientists, hopefully, in the media, the numbers are projected to going up. And of course, this has affected every single aspect of our lives. Such concerns about work and business and unemployment benefits and job loss. And, you know, I talk to parents all the time, and the concerns, should they be sending their children to school? Of course, here in New York, now the children are now being forced to being homeschooled. And look at how this impacts parents who actually have to go to work. I mean, I'm in a very, very fortunate position where I'm able to do all my psychotherapy and sex therapy and do the radio show, as much as I miss seeing the producers and going to the Progressive Radio Network offices. I mean, I haven't seen anybody live since March. And yet for me, it's working out okay. And yet for millions and millions of people, you know, in our country, the juggling that you're really having to do. And, you know, I really admire and I really am impressed with people who are just trying to stay the course despite the upsets, the concerns, the business losses, the job losses, and of course, our real, real worries still about the possibility of contracting the virus. And today I had a Via driver. Every Monday, I think I'd mentioned to you, I had pulled something in my hip a number of months ago when I was playing tennis. So I'm still seeing a chiropractor on a regular basis. And the Via driver this morning was a woman who is an emergency nurse. And she was saying she's been a nurse for many, many years, and her real, real concerns about the side effects of the virus. Should we take it now? Should we wait? Are we going to be getting it sooner or later? So in our life right now, there are so many, so many, so many real unknowns. And I continue, of course, to monitor what's going on with the depression statistics. 1 in 3 Americans are saying that they are suffering from depression of various different kinds, and it's understandably so. And the anxiety levels, just the day-to-day worries over and above the virus issues, are our relationships, problems that we all had prior to the pandemic, have all really been exacerbated since March. And people who are single or people who do not have families are really experiencing an enormous amount of loneliness, which of course translates into a lot of anxiousness and worry. And studies are telling us that people are drinking a lot more, exercising less. So that this is a really, really difficult time for all of us. And yet, you know, I was rereading my notes from a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, the notes came upon the Serenity Prayer. And it is so important. It is so important to accept the things that we cannot change. We cannot change our families. We cannot change our histories. We cannot change what did and did not happen in our relationship lives or in our professional lives. The history, as we all know, at least cognitively and pragmatically, the history from even a second ago, it is gone. It is gone. And hopefully we have learned something from our history. But it is about the courage to change the things that I can actually change. And it takes discipline. It takes self-discipline. It takes mindfulness. And sometimes it takes a coach, and sometimes it takes a therapist to remind all of us of the various things that we are actually able to do, not just to think about, not just to contemplate, not just to meditate about, but positive things that we can actually do every single day to improve the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships. So again, it's accepting the things I can't change. We cannot change what happened with the virus. What we can do, we can wear masks, we can maintain our social distance, we can wash our hands, we can be careful, we can avoid enclosed places. I mean, these are all things that are within our control. And of course, the wisdom to really know the difference. And of course, studies tell us the number one thing that is going to make all of us healthier and happier over and above the good diet and the plant-based diet and the Mediterranean diet, of course, are having really good, positive relationships. You know, and you know, right now I'm actually treating a number of people who are in disastrous relationships. And I think part of the problem is that they never learn, despite their Harvard degrees and their MBAs and their Ivy League education, what really healthy relationships are really all about. And they are convinced, and hopefully, you know, when they are done with their therapy with me, they're going to realize that we don't have the power. We don't have the power to change anyone at all. Only ourselves. So, you know, what I used to ask people to do once a year, and I can hardly believe that this is almost, I mean, Christmas is just in another week and a half. We're still in the middle of Hanukkah, and that 2020, which has been a challenging year to say the least, is really almost behind us. And hopefully 2021 is going to be a better year, you know, for all of us. But I think that there is a learning curve, whether or not we're talking about how to eat healthily or the importance of exercise or how to assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you when it comes to wanting and maintaining and sustaining, you know, healthy relationships. There is a mindset that all of us either have to buy into, or we are going to continue to repeat the mistakes of our history, and then wonder why life is still not working out in the ways that we would like. And the Japanese, and I know I've talked about this a lot, you know, the Japanese secret to a longer and happier life is having a purpose. You know, and I ask you, when you wake up every single morning, do you feel that you have a purpose, that there is a raison d'être for you to actually get out of bed? And it doesn't have to be a huge purpose. Maybe it's taking care of your dog. Maybe it's watering the plants. Maybe it's calling somebody and asking them, how are you feeling? And is there something that I can do for you? I mean, these little things, again, they don't have to be big philanthropic gifts where people are giving millions and zillions of dollars away. It's these small little things that really actually they bring us as much joy and happiness, if not more joy and happiness, than the recipients of our giving. And of course, we also have to, again, be mindful of the importance. And I know I talk about this on and on and on about the importance of physical fitness, and that it is so linked to heightened risk of mental disorders. And again, the studies are clear about weight training as an antidote for anxiety. And of course, I've told you what my regime is every single morning. I'm somebody that has issues with the seasonal affective disorder. So if you're interested in how Bidikon Reto starts her days, I wake up, and thank goodness my husband Jim is always around to welcome me and say good morning. And the first thing after, you know, we hug and kiss is that I put my lamp on for about 30 minutes. And this is a special lamp that we can easily buy online. I got mine on Amazon several years ago. So I sit under the lamp for about 30 minutes, and then I proceed to my weight training because we have free weights in my office. We have free weights in different parts of the house. So I do that for about 20 minutes, and hopefully it really does help to get my serotonin levels going. And then I'm able to begin my day. And I must confess, are there days and are there mornings that is the last thing in the world that I would like to do? Absolutely true. And yet, I am mindful. I'm mindful of the fact that this has been something, this routine has been something that has been very, very helpful to me for many, many years. And I am reluctant to make changes when I see that something has been working. So what I'm really asking you to do is to take a look at your days, and nights, and ask yourself, you know, are you basically, you know, nobody's ever perfectly happy with the quality of your days, with the quality of your life. And to ask yourself every day, and every day may be a little bit different, what can I do differently? We have a lot of information out there. Should I be modifying my diet? Is the person who I think I really want to get involved with, is this somebody who perhaps I should run to the closest exit and get away from this person because the relationship, as I'm seeing it, even in this early stage, is toxic. So it's about being honest with ourselves. It's about taking the time to evaluate and assess, I think, every day, and looking at the things that are actually in our best interest. And for those of you who've been listening to the Ask Beattie Show now for the, gosh, for the last number of years, today is the 300, and I do keep track, 34th Ask Beattie Show here on the Progressive Radio Network. It's really amazing how quickly the time has gone. And the reason why I do the show, and it's not because of ratings, and it's not because of views, and it's not because of downloads. I really hope that every single week when I go through some of the literature and talk with you about different study findings, that there is some little thing that I am going to say. It may not be the most monumental information in the world, but there's some little thing that you are going to say, aha, I think I've got it. I think I can now maybe try to make some changes, whether or not it is in my personal life, whether or not it is in my professional life. Perhaps I have to reassess who my friends are and who my friends are not. Perhaps I have some unfinished business with people in my life, either from my past or from my present, where there were problems and issues. And so oftentimes there are misunderstandings. And perhaps you once valued certain people and certain relationships that you had, and for reasons unknown, or maybe the reasons are known, the relationships ended, or there were strains and stresses that have not yet been dealt with. And Jim and I, we were talking about this over, you know, the weekend, that oftentimes in life, we only get one chance, one shot to try and make it right. And now with the holiday spirit, and hopefully we're all trying to cultivate a holiday spirit, think about, are there any people in your life who you have some unfinished business with that you would like to see if the relationships can't work. But of course, it's risky because there are no guarantees. And yet for me, I would rather be able to look in the mirror and say to myself, I tried to see whether or not there was something that I could do that could turn around a relationship that was once important to me that actually went off track. And I think that every day is a good day to try to do this, but especially with the, you know, the holiday season and the holiday sentimentality that most of us feel, one never knows. So rather than assuming what somebody thinks or doesn't think, if something is really important to you, I hope that my message today will inspire you and motivate you to actually reach out. And in talking about reaching out with the depression levels, 30% of Americans are now saying that they're feeling clinically depressed. 40% of Americans are saying that they are experiencing high levels of anxiety. It's really important to be able to talk about your feelings and not internalize the hurt, the scare, the pain, the worries, the anguish that you are actually experiencing on a day-to-day basis. Because if we don't, I mean, this really does, it affects our heart, it affects us physically in every possible way. And hopefully there are people in your life that you can talk to and that you can have honest conversations with. And instead of the typical, you know, reactive rote response when somebody asks you, how are you feeling? And you say, oh, well, I'm feeling just fine. When you know that you are not feeling fine at all, that you can find people in your own circle who you can really talk with. And there is nobody these days that I know who in some ways are not struggling. So getting it out and articulating and expressing is always a good thing to do. And then if you don't have people in your own inner circle or in your family, the very best thing that you actually can do is reach out for help. And, you know, I'll get emails from people and they'll ask me, if you are in therapy, B, does this mean that you are going to have to be in therapy forever? And of course, the answer is absolutely not. Most of the people that I see, they come in when there is a crisis. Typically, there is unfinished business and oftentimes what I call skeletons in their closet. Frequently, you know, beginning from their early family childhood. But, you know, we go through a process and, you know, most people absolutely do not need to be seeing a therapist on a regular basis. You know, on the other hand, there's some people who actually do need that ongoing support. And if you do not judge yourself. And if you don't, that's good. And people start therapy and they stop therapy. I think one of the things that I've found over the past 35 years is that people probably, they come in and they call a therapist primarily when there is a crisis. I don't think that there is anybody in all the years that I've been practicing who've ever called or emails or texts saying that I'd like to come in and improve my communication and problem solving skills. It would probably be a really good thing if we did, but you know, whether or not it is a crisis that is bringing you into therapy or whether or not you're thinking about, and of course these days we have a lot more time to contemplate all kinds of things since most of us are at home. Oftentimes we're at home way too much. But, you know, again, if you do have some unfinished business, whether or not it's early child sexual abuse or depression or issues from your past that you really and truly feel continue to get in the way and your life and your relationship, it's never too late. It's never too late to make that kind of a pivot. And again, going back to the serenity prayer, the courage to change the things that we can and can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. You know, I read over the weekend a very, very upsetting article, and this happened to be from U.S. News and World Report. And this is about suicide rates that are keep rising among young Americans. And this was a piece by Steven Reinberg. And what Steven Reinberg, who's a Health Day reporter, was saying is that a nearly 60% jump in suicides by young Americans since 2007 has experts alarmed and somewhat puzzled. Well, we should be extraordinarily alarmed, because suicide among children in young people ages 10 to 24, 10 years old. Just imagine little kids, 10, who are feeling that desperate, that alone, so disconnected that they would even think about or know about the idea of committing suicide. But young people ages 10 to 24, here again, rose 57%. From 2007 to 2018, according to a new report from the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And the actual numbers, I mean, these numbers, they are really scary. The suicide rate among 10 to 20-year-olds jumped about 100,000 in 2007 to nearly 11 per 100,000 in 2018. So, of course, what is suggested? That, of course, parents need to keep watch for signs that their children are troubled. And any time, and as a parent, I want to underscore this, that any time your child or a child, if you are a teacher or a guidance counselor, makes a statement to the effect of, "I don't think that people care if I die," or "I think people would be better off if I were not around," you've got to take this seriously. Also, if a child, if a young person withdraws from usual activities or is bullied on social media, it shouldn't be ignored. And I know that there's going to be more and more and more studies and more findings that are going to give us a lot better explanations. You know, I know that when I lived in Montreal, and of course you all know that I am Canadian and I have dual citizenship, of course. I was one of three directors of the entire school social services program for Greater Montreal. And we set up what I feel was the most effective intervention and identification school social services program that you could find actually anywhere, probably anywhere in the world. We had pupil personnel teams, and on these teams were school social workers. And in those days, every single school in Greater Montreal had a school social worker. And of course, that was the way I began after my graduate and postgraduate work at McGill. And everybody understood how this process actually works. So there was no child that was left behind. So we had the teachers and the psychologists and the guidance counselors and the principals and the vice principals. And if a child, not only if a child was acting out, I mean, that's easy, but if a child was withdrawn or not doing well academically, or if we could see that there were some social issues that was going on, every single child that met those criteria was referred for an assessment to a school social worker, just to make sure that we were not missing something really important. And if the social worker found that there were some issues, we had the family involved. I mean, I remember in the early days making home visits to parents' homes just to get an idea as to how the family and how the children were living, so that it was a real, it was such a wonderful, wonderful team approach. There was no stigma. It was just part of the school curriculum. And of course, it began in elementary school and also through junior high and high schools. And I remember doing all kinds of trainings, and my staff did trainings for teachers so that we would help them, again, be able to identify kids who might be struggling. And I don't know about what you might feel about this, but I think that this kind of a program should be an integral program in every single elementary and junior high school and high school in America. Yes, people might say that it would cost a lot of money, but look at the money that we are spending on mental illness in this country. And I feel strongly that if we had early identification in the schools, and I've been saying this for years and years and years, I mean, we would be able to have such a wonderful, wonderful major impact on mental health in America, because right now there is a real, real mental health crisis in this country. And therapy should not just be for the rich, or it should not just be for people who are fortunate enough to have health insurance where it is allowed, where you're allotted X number of mental health benefits so that you're able to see a counselor. When you think about it, we have art, we have physical education, although I think that probably a lot of these courses are also being cut because in quotes of so-called budgetary constraints. But this is something that is so important, the impact of prevention, the impact of early identification. I mean, we cannot be that ignorant and that short-sighted to see that this should become an integral part of our educational system. It worked so well. It worked so well for us in Montreal, and everybody. It was the most amazing things. I would go into, in those days, we had the Protestant school board that had, you know, hundreds of schools. And then we had the Catholic school board that had hundreds of schools. And it was so great. I mean, I would go in and I was invited and just embraced by the priest and the fathers and the others. I remember in the beginning, I had to learn the difference between a father and a brother, but it was great. And it really, really made all the difference in the world. I know for thousands and thousands of young children. So if there are any educators who are listening to this show right now, I hope at your next meeting, if you're going to have a Zoom meeting, and hopefully in the next 16, you know, 8 months or so, things may be a little bit back to normal, that this issue, this mental health crisis issue, and looking at the suicide statistics for young people, that this might be a really important item on your agenda. So moving forward, you know, beyond suicide, I was reading a number of articles that I am going to share with you about happiness. And I actually found a piece that I wrote a number of years ago that was published in a number of magazines. And I want to read this to you, and hopefully you will be able to give me a little bit of feedback. The call-in number here is 888-874-4888, and I would really love to hear from you. I think I mentioned when I first started with the Progressive Radio Network, I was really hoping that the Ask Beattie Show was going to be a live call-in counseling radio talk show, because I had done so many of those shows when I lived in other parts of the United States. But I think because of the fact that it's in the middle of the afternoon and things are online and things are changed, it did not turn into a call-in counseling show. But, you know, for those of you who are actually listening live right now, and if you have any issues, if you have any concerns, if you have any questions, we can discuss, we can debate. I'm always happy to hear from you through email, through text, and of course, on the show. And again, that number is 888-874-4888. So this is a piece that I wrote that I wanted to actually share with you. The piece is called Happiness. We are bombarded on a daily basis with advertisements and hype that tell us that living in a certain neighborhood, belonging to a particular country club, or buying a specific designer's handbag, car, or dress will assure us of everlasting happiness. Or what about the ads that promise us that a perfect body and an online face is the recipe for happiness? And if only it were that simple. Unfortunately, all these ads do is reinforce the false belief that luxurious homes and upscale communities on acre plus lots with luxury cars in our driveways are the very things that will improve the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships. No one will dispute the fact that it is lovely to wake up every morning in paradise to a beautiful house and landscaping on a preserve, a lake, or a golf course. However, if you believe for one moment that these luxuries in themselves will pave the way to genuine happiness, you will be sorely disappointed. And unfortunately, more and more people today are searching for happiness and inner peace in all the wrong places. Many years ago, when I first began to treat the rich and famous of the United States in my private practice, I quickly learned that having the mansion on the water or the private plane did not at all translate into being happy. My patients were as unhappy and depressed about their lives and relationships as my inner city clientele, who I treated in Montreal when I finished graduate school at McGill. In fact, the only real difference was that my wealthy patients had the resources to escape, in quotes, for short periods of time from their problems and their miserable relationships, only to return to their cycle of discontent and hopelessness. Sigmund Freud, he was right when he said that true happiness is about love and meaningful work. And if you believe this to be true, how much time this month did you spend on nurturing your relationships? Did you put as much energy into it as you did your job, or on designing your new home or your kitchen? Are you as committed to working out your individual and relationship problems as you are in working out the difficulties that you are having with your contractor or mortgage broker, or if you're lucky, your interior designer? Because no matter how hard Madison Avenue tries to convince us that buying the right kind of house or product will transform our lives, the truth lies elsewhere. So beginning today to fix the structural problems in your relationship with your spouse, your partner, your children, your grandchildren, your friends, or colleagues. Give these relationships the attention that they deserve. We live in a very, very narcissistic, it is all about me world. So perhaps you might consider giving back to people in your community or in disadvantaged communities around the world who are less fortunate than you are and who would appreciate your time, money, or commitment to their well-being. You know, for some, it might mean writing a check. Well, for others, a hands-on approach works best. All I can tell you, and this is really from the bottom of my heart, that in the 35 years plus that I have been a therapist, that I have probably received as much, if not more, than I have given emotionally. I've had the privilege of meeting and treating people who I would never have met in my own personal day-to-day life. And these relationships, they have taught me the true meaning of compassion and empathy. And I've also learned to appreciate the sacrifices that my parents, you know, when you're a child, you don't really ever think about this, made for me and the challenges that they faced as parents and partners and providers. And because of the fact that I've been fortunate enough to be in a position where I could do the kind of work that I love, in fact, I've actually never, ever thought of being a therapist, psychotherapist, and a sex therapist is work. For me, it has been a gift. I have a perspective on life that I never would have had I not been fortunate to be so intimately involved in human pain and suffering. For in the end, and I think this is something that we can all learn, I have learned that true happiness is about love, and the loving relationships that we create and have nurtured. And that is what happiness, my friends, is really, really all about. But I don't want you to just take my word, because I like to go to the literature and find out what other people, what researchers, psychologists, sociologists around the world have to say about the various different issues that I talk about. So in the New York Times, which is a regular source for me, I happened to find a piece, and the title is Happiness is Other People. Self-help gurus, they are just to look within, but joy in life is elsewhere. And I think that we've been told a lot. Happiness comes from within, and if happiness comes from within, and if we only were able to find our inner peace, our inner soul, then all would be well. However, the studies that I have found, they tell us something else. Self-reflection, introspection, and some degree of solitude, of course, are important parts of a psychologically healthy life. But somehow and somewhere along the line, we seem to have gotten out of balance, and we have gotten the balance wrong. Because far from confirming our insistence that happiness comes from within, a wide body of research tells us almost the exact opposite. Academic happiness studies are full of anomalies and contradictions, often revealing more about the agendas and values of those conducting them than the realities of human emotion. But there is one point on which virtually every piece of research into the nature and causes of human happiness agrees. It is this, and listen carefully, my friends, our happiness depends on other people. Study after study shows that good social relationships are the strongest, most consistent predictor of a happy life, even going so far as to call them a necessary condition for happiness, meaning that humans can't actually be happy without them. And this is a finding that cuts across race and age and gender and income and social class so overwhelmingly that it dwarfs any other factor. And according to other research studies, if we want to be happy, so please listen and take this in. If we want to be happy, we should really be aiming to spend less time alone. Despite claiming to crave solitude when asked in the abstract, when sampled in the moment, people across the board consistently report themselves as happier when they are around other people, when they are on their own. And surprisingly, this effect is not just true for people who consider themselves extroverts, but equally strong for introverts as well. But I want to add something to this. I think that it is not just, I don't think this is a contradiction in terms of what the findings are, but this is a, let's call it just an addition. I think it's not just about being around any people. It is about being around healthy people. You want to avoid toxicity at all costs. And when most people talk about toxins and when they talk about toxicity, they're talking about chemicals. Well, I'm talking primarily about toxic people, about poisonous people, people who are not there, people who are disrespectful, people who make us crazy, people who don't care for us, people who are not able and capable of any form of intimacy, people who invalidate us, people who absolutely add nothing to our lives other than chaos and unhappiness. So it is not just about having any people, anybody in our lives. It is having good people. It is having decent people. It is having emotionally healthy people in our lives that truly care about us as individuals. That is what I feel is really important. And I think this particular study, they don't actually go into this aspect. But academic happiness studies are full of anomalies and contradictions. But again, talking about the importance of having people in our lives. So again, that study after study shows that good social relationships, not just any relationships, but good social relationships are the strongest, most consistent predictor of a happy life. And according to other research, if we want to be happy, and these days so many people, when asked, say that they are unhappy, depressed, and anxious, we should really be aiming to spend less time alone. And despite claiming to crave solitude, when asked in the abstract, most people say that they are definitely feeling happier, including introverts, when they are surrounded by other human beings. And what's more, is neglecting our social relationships is actually shocking dangerous to our health, because research shows that a lack of social connection carries with it a risk of premature death comparable with that of smoking and is roughly twice as dangerous to our health as obesity. So the most significant thing that we can do for our well-being is not to find ourselves. You know how we talk about go find yourself or go within. It's to invest as much time and effort as we can into nurturing the relationships we have, good relationships, healthy relationships, not just any relationships we have with people in our lives. And given all of that, okay, the next time you have the choice between meditating. And I'm saying that meditation is fine. I mean, it's a good thing. And sitting in a bar with your friends complaining about meditation classes, you should probably seriously consider going to the bar. Well, as long as you don't drink too much, if anything, no matter what your happiness app says. And I really do wonder what you think about that. Because so oftentimes, you know, we look outside of ourselves to find happiness. We look at what kind of school we went to. Did you go to an Ivy League school? Okay. Did you get a PhD? Did you earn X number of dollars? Do you live in a certain neighborhood? Have you visited this place and that place? Do you have a second home? I mean, it's as if we are being so conned, and it's really true, by Madison Avenue to think that it is the stuff, that it is the things that are going to really, really bring us happiness. And yet there are studies, there are actually studies that that talk about this. And in fact, there was a study, and I'm just trying to find the reference here, that there is actually a certain amount of money, that after a certain amount of money that you are making, that your happiness level absolutely does not go up. And guess what that set amount of money is? And you're probably really going to be surprised. And the studies show, all right, this is something that I wanted to read from you, that when people making $30,000 a year, and this is a researcher, her name is Dr. Lynn Bormisky, something like that. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. So she talks about when people making $30,000 a year ask what kind of annual salary it would take to make them truly happy. The average answer in her studies has been $50,000. So people making $30,000 think that $50,000 is going to make them happy. When you ask the same question of people making $100,000 a year, you'd expect them to say, I am doubly happy. I am making twice the happiness threshold. Instead, what they actually say on average is that if they made $250,000 a year, then they would be truly happy. So you might think that means that there is no set monetary amount that brings happiness, but that's not entirely true either. In fact, according to studies, there is a set amount. And guess what that amount is? It happens to be $75,000. At least that's what the Nobel Prize winning economists, Daniel Kahneman and Angus Deaton, found when they studied 1,000 American households. They reported well-being rises with income until you hit $75,000, at which point it levels off. And beyond that, there is no observable increase in happiness with higher incomes. But the point does remain, look, we need the basics, is that once our basic needs are met, the lodging, the food, the relationship between money and happiness becomes purely theoretical. And a researcher found that when incoming freshmen, this is interesting, in American colleges were asked what they valued, 7% reported that developing a meaningful philosophy of life was important to them, while only 42% valued being well off financially. And this was in 1967. So how things have changed. So 67, developing a meaningful philosophy of life, that was what important. But look at how things have changed by 2005, those numbers had reversed. 71% of freshmen valued being well off, while only 52% valued a meaningful life philosophy. And yet, this researcher, her name is Dr. Santos, she does offer a silver lining for her students, pointing out that the median income level of Yale grads by age 34 is $76,000, almost exactly the salary scientifically proven to provide the maximum amount of well-being. Well, the thing that really was interesting to me is that when I finished my graduate and postgraduate work at McGill University, I was a school social worker in the inner city schools of Greater Montreal. And most of the families that I was working with at the time were on welfare or some type of assistance. And of course, I was seeing them because their children were having issues in the school setting. And there was, of course, there was the concern about money. And how are we going to pay the bills? Were we going to be able to afford our rent? You know, over and above the other issues that we all deal with, you know, marital issues, parent-child issues, family issues. But what was surprising to me, and I think at, in 1970, a very naive, in the last many, many years, so many of the people that I have treated have had just incredible wealth. I mean, really incredible wealth. And yet, just like the studies are pointing out, their happiness levels were not anywhere different than the people who I treated in the inner city areas. Now, maybe for a day, I remember there was one woman who I treated. She had a terrible marriage, had severe depression, had a lot of different issues. And she would go to New York. She would go to New York and she would go to Tiffany's and she would buy herself a diamond bracelet. And her happiness level, it certainly would, it would come up for a day or for a couple of days. So like all the studies have taught us that it is absolutely the quality of our relationships that make the difference and really that make or break our lives. And we have to, I think, begin to really take this in because Laurie Santos, who's a professor at Yale, she developed a course. It became the most talked about course in America where she was looking at happiness. And what she found in all of her work is that college students, and this is current work, current teachings, that college students aren't happy. And of course, Laurie says neither is anybody else, but I don't think that that's true. And according to a recent study by the American College Health Association, 52% of students reported feeling hopeless. Well, 39% suffered from such severe depression that they found it almost impossible to get up during the day. So that we really have to be looking at and educating students and educating ourselves about what are the things that we really need to do that are in our best interest that will help to make us feel happy. And maybe keeping a gratitude journal to think about all of the wonderful things, or the good things that we do have in our lives, even though it may not be exactly the things that we thought that should make us happy. And having responsibility over someone else, getting out of our own narcissism. You know, a kid, a pet, a garden, thinking small and trying to figure out on a day-to-day basis what are the really important things. And it's not the Tiffany bracelets, and it's not the houses on the water or the private planes that are going to do it. But in effect, what we've been talking about and what I talk about on the Ask BD show every week It is making sure that we are cultivating healthy relationships and that we are on a path in our lives, professionally and personally, that is constructive, and making sure that we do everything possible to avoid self-sabotaging and doing things that are not in our best interest and that are in fact self-destructive and destructive. And I have so many other things that I really wanted to talk about, and I'm looking at the time and the time is gone. And I want to make sure that I end with my two weekly important messages to you. And number one, of course, is to make sure that we do everything that we can possibly do that is in our best interest. That does not mean being selfish, so that we are being good to ourselves. And of course, secondly, we need to do everything possible that we can possibly do to make sure that we are giving and that we are aware of what's going on in this world and taking care of each other and loving each other in much, much better ways than we currently do.